You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about a surprise historical discovery at the Wisconsin State Herbarium. First, yesterday, North Korea successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially reach the coast of Alaska. Russia and China issued a joint press statement calling for North Korea to stop its missile and nuclear programs in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea holding off on joint military drills in the future. But within a few hours, the U.S. and South Korea announced that they had held a new military missile drill in response to the North's missile test. Andrew Kidd joins us now to talk about this news and what it could mean for U.S. foreign policy. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So how big of a deal is this particular missile test from North Korea?
It's a big deal. It's kind of as big a deal as we choose to make of it. It doesn't actually augment the North Korean capabilities now. They can't do anything today that they couldn't do yesterday. But it shows that they're making progress towards developing a rocket that could hit the United States. This missile that was tested, if it was tested on a flatter trajectory, could hit Alaska and part of Hawaii, and possibly it could be developed to hit the rest of the United States. And if they were able to put a warhead, nuclear warhead, on such a missile, that would represent a serious capability that they don't have now. But right now, they can hit South Korea and they can hit Japan. So it would be a matter of hitting the United States as well as those other two countries.
And what did we hear from the North Korean state media about the missile test?
Well, they have a sort of they have a little sarcastic message for the United States saying, here's a little present for you on the 4th of July to relieve the boredom. So they were kind of trying to tweak our noses a little bit on that, I would say.
And how has the U.S. responded so far? Let's start with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
Well, they've been saying that the message overall for the past couple of weeks and even really going back a couple of months is that the era of strategic patience is over. That's how they're characterizing the Obama policy, which was essentially we're going to wait for the North Korean regime to collapse of its own initiative and then pick up the pieces later on. And they're saying we're not going to do that. But they've also mostly forsworn any negotiations with North Korea. So they're basically left with two tacks. One is trying to have greater sanctions placed upon North Korea. And for that, they needed China's help, and so they've been trying to get China to help. But recently, they've been expressing dissatisfaction with the level of assistance that they've gotten from China in that endeavor, and so they are starting to rattle the saber a bit and make veiled military threats, and some not-so-veiled military threats. And it's an interesting thing to remember that Trump himself, shortly before he was inaugurated, back in January at least, I had mentioned that the North Koreans will not be allowed to develop an ICBM, and this is, of course, just precisely that. So,
intercontinental ballistic missile, right?
Yes, an intercontinental ballistic missile, essentially a missile capable of crossing the ocean and hitting the United States. So this is a direct affront to that statement, and we'll see what the upshot is.
President Trump has called, especially on China in the past, to try to rein in North Korea, thinking that they have more influence there. What has President Trump said in light of this latest test?
Well, he's been increasingly critical of China and their, in his view, inadequate level of pressure on North Korea. And so he is making more belligerent statements. He had a phone call with Xi Jinping, the leader of China, just last Sunday, expressing dissatisfaction with that. And so we're going to see more of that, I think, coming from the White House.
We have a caller, Roland in Eau Claire, on the phone. Let's go there. Hi, Roland.
Good afternoon. I have a suggestion. I think President Trump should go to Congress and ask for a congressional declaration of war, something we haven't done since the 1940s. Once he gets a congressional declaration of war, he can act with North Korea. He could tell North Korea that if they give up their missile program and their nuclear program and they allow UN inspections, then the United States will not attack. But if North Korea refuses and the United States has a right of self-defense, this is the most terrifying threat we've had since the Cuban Missile Crisis when Khrushchev put missiles into Cuba.
All right. Thanks for that call, Roland. And Andrew, what is the congressional role in this?
The congressional role is, well, it's very unlikely to be a declaration of war. We have not declared war, as the caller pointed out, since World War II, despite the fact that we fought Korea and Vietnam, which were substantial wars, and also the various wars in the Middle East, the first Gulf War and the most recent one in 2003. Countries don't declare war anymore. It's an interesting development from international legal perspective. But more broadly, from the congressional perspective, what typically happens is that the president, if they contemplate a major military action, will go to Congress for some sort of authorization, some sort of approval, expression of approval, authorization to use force. And so if Trump was actually serious about using force against Korea, it's conceivable that he might do that. On the other hand, the kind of force that he would probably be contemplating using would be a very short, quick surprise attack on the nuclear facilities and the missile facilities. And so it would forfeit a lot of the advantage of surprise to sort of ratchet up a gradual, long crisis and take it to Congress and have a debate there and get an authorization. It would really make it a lot easier for the North Koreans to hide, dig tunnels, even more tunnels than they already have, hide all their materials, and so basically negate the effect of the strike. So my guess is that he would be advised by his military not to even do that.
We're talking right now with Andrew Kidd, professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison, and we're talking about North Korea's successful test of an intercontinental ballistic missile yesterday that has the potential reach of the coast of Alaska. Andrew, one thing I want to point out is that, you know, this missile reached could potentially reach American soil, but we actually have 28,500 troops, U.S. troops, in South Korea right now, which has been within the range of North Korean traditional missiles or traditional weapons for a long time. Do you anticipate that were the North to move in an aggressive way, would it be against the South and the U.S. presence there, or possibly Japan, which is also much closer, or are they really trying to reach the continental U.S.?
My sense is that the North Koreans are probably not going to launch a first strike, either with conventional weapons, or either with nuclear weapons, or even with conventional weapons, because they know that they would lose the resulting war, and that would be the end of their regime and the end of them personally. So I don't think they're going to do that. What they're building these weapons for almost certainly is for deterrence. That is, in order to try to prevent the United States and South Korea from undermining their regime, taking advantage of any instability that might arise there to move forces in if the regime began to collapse, basically to do what we did in Libya, what we've done covertly in Syria, what we did in Afghanistan, what we did against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, which is to overthrow or help local people overthrow a regime that we don't like. And they know that we don't like them, of course, that's obvious. So they have essentially correct fears that we would like to overthrow their regime, and they think that if you've got nuclear weapons, then you can deter the United States from doing that. Now, the reality is that they've been able to deter the United States since 1994. We contemplated attacking them over the nuclear issue in 1994 and didn't do it because they had conventional capabilities, namely artillery, that could hit the capital of South Korea, Seoul, which is not that far from the border with North Korea. And so even then, already, they could kill potentially tens, maybe even over 100,000 South Koreans in the opening days of a war. And that was enough to deter us. We just were not going to attack given that fact. So one could argue that he's sort of buying a lot of extra deterrence here. We were already deterred, but now we're even more deterred. But they seem to feel that that's necessary, and that's the direction they're going.
The new South Korean president, just elected earlier this year, is pushing for engagement with North Korea rather than a policy of confrontation. Do you think President Moon is going to stand by that given this new development? And where does that put him in relation to other allies?
I'm sorry, there's a little beeping there. I think it must be a thunderstorm warning. He may try to stand by that. The problem with that is that that policy has been tried back in the 1990s, leading up to 2000, most prominently by the Prime Minister Kim Dae-jung, who was famous for the so-called Sunshine Policy of cooperation with the North, trying to build economic ties, trying to build human ties, people going back and forth, things like that, with the idea that we want to reassure North Korea and build trust and cooperation gradually rather than threaten North Korea. And so that policy was tried. It was given a pretty fair try, and there were some joint economic programs and factories and whatnot, and tourism going back and forth a little bit. But the fundamental problem is that the North Korean regime can't really survive as a normal country because they are so heavily overshadowed by South Korea. South Korea is so much more successful than North Korea that it's really, once the North Korean people figure out that basically they've been starved and lied to for the past 50 years, the North Korean leadership fears, I think correctly, that there's going to be hell to pay. And so they have to maintain secrecy. They have to maintain an informational blockade against what life is really like in South Korea. So there's a real limit to how open they're ever going to be and what, you know, what they might be willing to do in terms of cooperation with the South. And it later came out that even the big triumphs of the Sunshine Policy era were essentially bought and paid for by the South Korean government. They essentially bribed the North Koreans to have summit meetings with them and to open these industrial parks and things like that. So it was not as benign a picture as it was portrayed as.
And just briefly as we wrap up, Andrew, what do you think will be the likely reaction from the global community to this most recent North Korean missile test?
I think you're going to get more of the same. I mean, I don't think the international the problem is that the international community doesn't have a lot of leverage here because North Korea is so intensely isolated already. There's really not that much more that can be done in the way of peaceful tools, even including economic sanctions. Not many countries have any links to North Korea, so it really is down to China in terms of the country that could have leverage. But the problem with China is, of course, they don't want to exert too much leverage. They don't want to threaten the North Korean regime too much because they're worried that it would collapse, and that would be bad for China because then South Korea would essentially take over with the United States troops right away.
And we lost Andrew, but thank you, Andrew, so much for being with us today. That was Andrew Kidd, professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the news that North Korea recently successfully tested a long-range missile with the potential to reach the coast of Alaska. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Weather extremes are nothing new in Wisconsin. We tend to call them winter and summer. Helene Phelps tells us about the heat and how she deals with it in her part of Wisconsin.
It's hot in Wisconsin, really hot. Temps in the 90s. Real feel heat index, say the meteorologists, is plus a dozen digits. That's because here in Wisconsin, it's also really, really humid. What would you say? 90%? 100? Sticky drips roll down foreheads, necks, and spines. The storms come almost every night. Big ones. Electrical light shows firing the sky like a million tinsel arrows. Thunder clapping directly over our heads and houses, appreciative of the release from waterlogged cloud cover. Enough rain to close highways and wash out bridges, destroy corn crops, and find folks weeping in flooded basements. Power down. Trees, too. We are free from drought, and the forecast is more than a slight chance of same tomorrow. Yes, it's hot in Wisconsin, and if you think we're complaining, you would be absolutely right. True, we complain, but we also tough it out, especially those of us without air conditioning. We check on our neighbors and draw the curtains down tight come daylight. We spent hours cooling off at the public library and next to the open cases in the grocer's produce section. We drink water and eat sandwiches, leaving the stove to gather dewdrops. We watch the grass grow faster than our own feet can carry us. We actually long for winter, and we wait for cool breezes. In Wisconsin, we nod in agreement that hot here is different than hot in Southern California or Arizona deserts. There are tricks for cooling down when the mercury climbs and the dew point makes for slick traveling on linoleum floors. Tricks our mothers pulled out of the ice chest long before AC was an acronym. Stretched out on cotton sheets, four or more cold, wet washcloths were gently placed on small bodies. We shivered with the first touch of terry cloth, and then we settled into deep, restless summer sleep. Foggy dreams and listless limbs, we did not move an inch until the birdsong of a new, too warm morning pulled us awake. Electricity saved the day if you had a fan and a bowl of ice cubes to set in the blade's spinning pathway. Physics at its finest and its coolest. Hoses and sprinklers, neighborhood ponds and woodland streams cooled our feet and bellies. We ate cherry popsicles. Then, out of the blue, the Fahrenheit shifts downward. The haze slowly evaporates along with the relative humidity. The pavement no longer sizzles. There is an emotional shift with the lift, a lighter step and a belief that our day-to-day lives will return to normal, the extended outlook brighter on all accounts. But today, the cirrus cloud cover promises more rain. The temperature climbs like a bottle rocket. The afternoon stillness forces the dew point higher by the minute. It's hot in Wisconsin. I think we should all go jump in the lake.
Helene Phelps is a writer in northern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the Wisconsin State Herbarium houses over a million biological specimens from plants to algae to lichen. So maybe it's not surprising that some samples may have been misplaced over a century ago. Here to tell us about a recent rediscovery of moss specimens at the herbarium is Ken Cameron, professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I read about where you found these lost moss specimens, and I thought it was really pretty amusing. Where did you find them?
Well, the State Herbarium on the UW campus in Madison, as you said, has a collection of over 1.3 million preserved research and teaching specimens. And over the last 100 years, we'd simply grown out of space to accommodate all those collections. And maybe, like you and your listeners, we stash things away wherever we can, right? Up in the attic, in the basement, out in
nooks,
the hallways.
Crannies, yep.
Yeah, and the truth is that we're fortunate to acquire some new space in historic Burge Hall. And as we were doing, you know, quote unquote, spring cleaning to move into that new space, we found these specimens literally upstairs in cardboard boxes.
Wow. And what I found really interesting reading about this is that these moss specimens can actually provide really important information about what was going on in the environment 100 plus years ago.
That's correct. We found one set of around 500 specimens that were still in their original paper bags collected in the summer of 1901.
Wow.
Up on Isle Royale in Lake Superior. And imagine, this is several decades before Isle Royale was made a national park. That happened in 1940. Hmm. So these are specimens well over 100 years old. Another set of around 1,500 specimens were collected by a former botany professor and curator named Leland Cheney in the 1920s.
Wow. So this is a part of our environmental history that maybe we didn't have access to before.
It is. And your listeners may know that mosses and lichens and some of these plants are almost like the amphibians of the plant world. They are very sensitive to pollution, to environmental change, to air quality. And so there are some new methods out there that scientists can use to examine the chemical makeup of these historic specimens and compare them to today's living mosses or lichens or other plant material.
I have to say, I chuckled when I saw that this discovery had been made because a while back we spoke with you about the herbarium finding some old microfungus specimens that were collected by George Washington Carver. And given the sheer volume of specimens that you have, it's certainly not surprising. I couldn't keep track of it all, but do you think maybe there are other little treasures that are tucked away?
This is the really fun part of my job, and I think anyone who works either in science or history, what you can stumble upon each day is really unknown. And the applications of these specimens for the future is unknown. And so I really find that a joy. I will say that we take advantage of the fact that we've been databasing and putting online on the internet all of our collection data. And it was only by being able to compare the online catalog mm-hmm. to these new specimens that we actually realized they were new and distinct and had not been cataloged or accessioned previously.
And is that the UW 2020 project?
That's one of them. We've been supported through funding by the National Science Foundation, and then, as you mentioned, more recently, a new project sponsored by the by WARF here on the mm-hmm. UW-Madison campus called UW 2020 is actually bringing all of our natural history collections together.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for coming in today and telling us about the latest rediscovery.
You're welcome.
Ken Cameron is a professor of botany at the UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. We've been talking about a recent rediscovery of moss specimens at the State Herbarium. The summer job was once considered part of every American teen's life. In the summer of 1978, for example, 60% of teens were working or looking for work. But last summer, only 35% of teens were employed or looking for a job. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. He recently reported on why teens have stopped getting summer jobs. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I think when people hear that so many fewer teens are getting those summer jobs, they write it off as teens being lazy. But you say right away in your article that's not the case. Why not?
I agree. I think they do kind of default to the idea that if kids aren't working, then they must be lazy and they're just sitting on their couches and playing Xbox or PlayStation 4 or something. But the data suggests something slightly different, or actually rather dramatically different. It finds that the number of teenagers who are enrolled in summer school has actually quintupled since 1985, increased by about a factor of five. It finds that teens are much more likely to graduate from high school with more degrees, with more classes under their belt in calculus and science and foreign languages. It also happens to be the case that the exact percentage point decline in teenagers who are working over the summer, which, as you helpfully pointed out, is about 25% percentage points, down from about 60 to about 35, that is exactly the percentage increase in the number of teenagers who are going off to college. So, yes, you're right. At first, it seems like these teenagers are just being lazy. They're not working. They're choosing to hang out and do nothing over the summer, when in fact, they're doing the exact opposite. They're investing in their future. They're more likely to take classes, graduate high school on time, and enroll in college.
So is that a necessity now to do that extra academic work in the summers, maybe, you know, at a local community college or online or something? Is that now a requirement to graduate well from high school and to go on to a good college education?
I think you're seeing a few things. First, you're seeing an arms race when it comes to buffing up one's portfolio for college. Now, the vast majority of people who apply to college do not apply to highly selective schools. They apply to places that accept more than half of their applicants, public schools and community colleges and the like. So another thing that's happening is that I think it's possible that some teenagers are feeling pushed out of certain jobs. And there you have to look to the broader labor market. And it turns out that people over the age of 55 are much more likely to work than they used to. And the U.S. economy has added a lot of low-skill immigrants since the 1980s, when this trend really started. So if you look at the kind of jobs that teenagers used to have over the summer in retail, office administration, maybe scooping ice cream, these jobs still exist. They're just much more likely to be done by older native-born Americans or by younger low-skill immigrants.
So as we're looking at the U.S. labor force right now, there are many thousands of baby boomers who either recently retired or are about to retire. Some of those are maybe coming back into the workforce to take some of those jobs. They're not quite ready to be completely retired for a variety of reasons. But is there maybe going to be another shift as more and more of those baby boomers actually stop working for good?
That's a good question. You're absolutely right. It's possible that as that generation retires, that these jobs will open up. And maybe, you know, teenagers will want to take them. I think another question that's interesting to ask is, you know, what happens during an economy like ours right now, today, where you have extremely low unemployment, a bit of wage pressure at the bottom, lots of summer positions that both anecdotally I've heard are going unfilled throughout the country. Will there be a pressure for these employers to raise wages a bit and try to hire teenagers? That's a possibility. We might be speaking, you and me, right now, at the very bottom of this cycle, of this teenage summer job cycle. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, economists and journalists might say, "Oh well, it fell, you know, about 40% between the late 1970s and say 2017, and then it started to come up a bit." I've seen lots of evidence in this economy that we might be at the bottom of that cycle, but we'll just have to wait and see to know for sure.
So, Derek, we talked about the students, the teens, who instead of working summer jobs are doing academic programs, trying to get a leg up in that way. But there's also, in your article, you document that there has been a big rise in unpaid internships. What kind of impact is that having?
Right. This is so important. The government does not have great data on unpaid internships, but there is private sector data which has found an enormous rise in unpaid internships in the last few decades. Why would this matter for the purpose of summer jobs? Well, unpaid internships are summer jobs, but they're not paid. And so the government does not count it as working. And so this is a bit of a trick that's being played on teenagers, you might say, because the teenagers might be working today in an unpaid position just as they were working 20, 30 years ago in a paid position, but it no longer looks like they're working when you look at the government data, which is what most of us are going by. So, you know, we can have an entire segment about the ethics and morality of unpaid internships. I think that's a complicated issue, too. What's not complicated is the fact that unpaid internships are much more common. Teenagers are doing them, but it looks, from the government statistical standpoint, like these teenagers are not working because they are not accepting a wage.
We're talking with Derek Thompson right now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, and he recently wrote about why teens have stopped getting summer jobs. And Derek, you use a term that I think is important to bring up at this point, which the acronym is NEET, neither in education, employment, or training. So we've talked about kids who are doing the academic programs, we've talked about the kids who are still working, and we've talked about these unpaid internships. Who are the kids who don't fall into any of those categories?
Right, NEETs, right, and that's N-E-E-T, neither in education, employment, or training. This is a really important stat to look at. If you are trying to answer the question, are teenagers lazier now than they used to be? Are they more likely to be idle, doing nothing? That would be captured in this NEET figure. And according to the OECD, which tracks NEETs, the answer is no, they are not lazier. The share of young people who are NEETs, neither in education, employment, or training, has not really budged since the 1990s, even though in this period the number of people working during the summer has declined by a lot. And that suggests rather strongly the first point that I made in the segment, which is that these teenagers are not simply doing nothing. They are trading a job for a class. They are less likely to work at the ice cream shop, but they are more likely to take that ethics or calculus class over the summer.
We're talking with Derek Thompson about why teens have stopped getting summer jobs, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you see generational differences when it comes to teens getting summer jobs? If you're close to a teen, what are they doing over the summer? And if you had a summer job as a teen, what did you learn from it? Call now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our discussion now with Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about his piece on why teens aren't getting summer jobs anymore. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think teens have stopped getting summer jobs? Are they there and they just don't want them, or has that dried up for young people today? What did you learn from your summer job as a teenager? And if you're a teen, call in and tell us what you think about getting a summer job. What are you doing now that school is out? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And I just wanted to share one thing, Derek, before we get to some of our callers. You know, the difference between when I was a teen in the 70s, early 80s, and my daughter, who's in her early 20s now, is that there were a lot of summer jobs. It felt like you could almost choose what kind of summer job you wanted, what kind of hours or how many hours you wanted. When she was in high school, really, the only way to have a summer job was if you worked that job all year round in high school. You could then ramp up your hours in the summer, but you had to have your foot in the door there already in order to have work in the summer.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I think it's fair to say that for a certain kind of teenager, it is much, much more competitive in terms of both academics and work experience. They are hustling to finish classes, AP classes, that they are ready to start college on the right foot. They're also trying to get a bunch of unpaid internships under their belt that adds a certain prestige. It really is an arms race. And as a result, I think you have a lot of people who used to take summer positions, used to take summer jobs, no longer doing so. Another thing that's important to point out is that historically, it has been both richer families and white families that are more likely to have their kids do summer positions. In fact, if you go back to the 1970s and you look at the participation rate of black teenagers during the regular year and during the summer, what you find actually is that there isn't much of a bump during the summer in terms of their labor force participation. This suggests that when you look at what many people might consider sort of the heyday of the summer job in the 1960s, 70s, 1980s, it really was much more of a white teenager phenomenon than a black teenager phenomenon. And I think that's just an important piece of information in the discussion about American nostalgia for the teenage job.
Let's go to the phones now, and Caroline is on the phone from Appleton. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to share?
Well, I'm a 16-year-old student, and I do not have a summer job, and my parents don't require me to have one. And that reason is because the way I spend my summer time, I believe, is investing towards my future, and particularly because with the way that college tuition has increased so exponentially, getting a summer job really can't make a dent in your tuition. The best it can do is maybe pay for your living expenses for a year or two. But if you are working towards getting your AP classes so you can graduate early, a lot of times I know that I will take summer classes so that I can free up my schedule for more classes during the year. Particularly, I engage myself in a lot of extracurriculars during the summer so that I can get into a college with a good endowment or apply for scholarships that can actually pay off more monetarily in the future than getting a summer job.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that, Caroline. And Derek, it sounds like Caroline is being very strategic about how she's spending her summers and really looking at, kind of the cost-benefit analysis.
Exactly. That's exactly the word I was going to use. This is a great example of a cost-benefit analysis, that it's essentially saying if the summer job is going to pay something close to a minimum wage and college itself is expensive and the college premium, that which I expect to earn after I graduate from college, thanks to my education, is a higher wage, then why waste my time, you know, delivering pizza, scooping ice cream for practically nothing for a few months during the summer? It's barely going to provide me enough money to buy, you know, a dress, a couple pairs of, shirts, pants, depending on the gender of the student. And then, you know, that's basically it, versus, you know, being much better prepared for college or maybe even getting into a better school. So I think that this cost-benefit analysis is exactly right, and it's something that a lot of teenagers are making. Realizing how low the minimum wage is and how valuable a college education is, it just makes more sense for a lot of them to not waste time with a summer job, but rather invest in their education.
Caroline, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And let's go next to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yes, I was working for a company here in Madison. It's a very large telecom firm with cable, the own cable companies. And one of the things that they did on a fairly regular practice was to hire, didn't hire them, but they brought in like 10 or a dozen interns to do their drafting underground wire in telecom. And with no intention of hiring them.
Mm-hmm.
They would give the promise, you know, the carrot out there that if they did well, they'd hire them. And these kids would work there for 8 months, and they'd let them all go and maybe keep one, if that, and then they'd do it all over again, year after year.
Thanks for that call, Mike. And Derek, I think that maybe the idea behind internships has also changed over the years, because I think in an earlier generation, an internship was a foot in the door at a particular company where maybe you would end up working and maybe spending your whole career there. But it feels like more today it's getting a variety of experiences to put on your resume.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that, you know, certainly the internships for me were a way of, you know, testing out certain jobs and certain industries that I might be interested in. And none of my internships were actually in journalism, and I'm now a journalist. So it goes to show that you can sample from parts of the buffet that you don't commit to. I'm mixing all sorts of metaphors here, so I apologize. But I should have thought about it a little before the call. But I think this is exactly right. I do think that there is a bit of an ethical question, however, when it comes to unpaid internships, because what's essentially happening is that, yes, it is sort of standing in for education, and that's a nice thing. It's giving someone access to a position they might not have access to if that company had to pay them a wage. They might just choose not to have the unpaid internship. But at the same time, there are lots of unpaid internships that are essentially work, right? The 19-year-old, the 22-year-old, maybe the 27-year-old is doing work for that company, but the company has managed to brand what used to be a job as an unpaid internship, where the compensation is merely the beneficial experience to that individual's a future career. And that strikes me as a little bit problematic and a little bit unfair, because often you have what should be salaried jobs, paid jobs, being turned into unpaid internships. So, you know, from the student's perspective, I think it's smart to rack up as much experience as they can afford and as they can manage into their schedule. But I also think that it might be better both for individual students and employers and employees if some of these unpaid internships were merely paid positions.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, talking about summer jobs and the various reasons why young people are not working in the summers as much now as they used to. Shelley on Facebook said, I work in a high school. We have a lot of kids here all summer long for athletic camps and summer school. Too much pressure for some of them. And, you know, Derek, that brings up an interesting point. Is there something to be said for kind of a mindless summer job? You mentioned like scooping ice cream or, you know, something like that. Maybe giving your brain a break during those summer months.
Sure. When it comes to, you know, suggesting what tens of millions of teenagers should do over the summer, my default position here is pretty laissez-faire. I think they should do what they want, and often, I suppose I should add, they should listen to their parents, if there are parents who are listening into the call, hoping that I'm not giving away too much authority to their teenagers. But essentially what I'm saying is I don't want to give a blanket piece of advice for tens of millions of people I don't know. For some of them, it absolutely makes sense to work to supplement their family's income. For other families, which don't really need supplemental income from their 16-year-olds, it might make the most sense to go to summer school school or take an internship that's going to expose them to some industry that they're somewhat curious in. And yet for others who are lucky enough to travel, they should take up that experience and see the world, and it should, you know, broaden their horizons and inform their perspective. There are lots of different experiences that teenagers have and lots of different family circumstances that play into the decision of what they should do for these 3 months. But I think that the so-called right answer should probably be decided at a level more local and intimate than I can provide sitting here talking to you on the phone.
Well, and here's an interesting aspect that you brought up in your article, that one of the reasons that teens aren't getting summer jobs is cultural. And what I find interesting about that is that shifts when you look at there being many fewer teens who are working. Tell us about that cultural component.
Yeah, it's tough to write about culture sometimes from an economic perspective because there aren't great numbers when it comes to social influence. These are things that often have to be proved in social psychology studies rather than observed in government data. But it just sort of makes sense. Let's think of it this way. It's the 1970s. Let's say it's the 1970s, and I'm a 15-year-old college freshman, and I see that all the cool upperclassmen are scooping ice cream at, you know, Bob's ice cream shop right down the street. What am I going to look forward to when I'm a junior or a senior? I'm going to look forward to scooping ice cream. That's what all the cool kids are doing. I'm going to look forward to doing that summer job. But now let's fast forward 40 years and imagine that, again, I'm a 15-year-old freshman, and what are all the cool kids who are upperclassmen doing with their summers? Well, they're actually taking ethics. They're taking this ethics class, and they're, you know, having fun in this ethics class and, you know, talking to girls in this ethics class. What am I going to want to do as that 15-year-old freshman? I'm going to want to take that ethics class. Teenagers are unbelievably susceptible to peer pressure and social influence, and they want to do that which they perceive as being cool. And so I think it's important to note that some of these economic changes that might be dissuading, you know, 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds from working in the same ice cream shops that they used to work in, they have trickle-down effects and amplification effects as younger people see, oh, I understand now the right thing to do isn't to work, it's to study. And so I merely mean in this section where I began to talk about culture, that culture can amplify economic effects because young teenagers mimic older teenagers.
And Kelsey on Facebook left a comment. I worked all through middle and high school when I went to college and was able to just focus on my studying. I was shocked at how thin I'd stretched myself and how stressed I'd been from 12 to 18 years old. Is it so bad if teenagers aren't working these days?
No, I don't think it's necessarily so bad. I think that investing in your education is just fine. You know, it might be bad if, let's say, nobody was scooping ice cream, that there were all, you know, millions of consumers who, you know, wanted Rocky Road ice cream, and you had workers refusing to scoop it for whatever reason. You know, that would be bad. But that's not the case. You know, you go to ice cream shops, and there are people behind the counter. They just might be a little bit older. They might be older than might be in their 20s. They might be, you know, immigrants, or they might be people over 50. They could be all sorts of ages. But the point is that the fact that that summer job opportunity has gone away for teenagers doesn't mean the job has disappeared. So I think it's important to note that in many ways the story of teenagers and summer jobs is sort of a happy story about an adaptable economy.
And we'll have to leave it there. Derek, thanks so much for being with us today. That was Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic magazine.